Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming later this hour, an unusual proposed law affecting horses and the Amish. But up front, it wasn't long ago that someone who contracted the HIV virus that developed into AIDS would probably die. Today, the 1 million Americans and 36,000 Pennsylvanians living with HIV live relatively normal lives through treatment. But not everyone living with HIV even knows that they are infected. And that's why testing is important. We'll discuss treatment, advancements, and other aspects of living with HIV on today's program. Joining us is Patricia Fonzi, President and CEO at the Family Health Council of Central Pennsylvania. Ms. Fonzi, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Also joining us, Dr. Adam Lake, a family physician at Penn Medicine Lancaster General Health. Dr. Lake, good to see you this morning.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@wytf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Patricia Fonzi, your organization recently launched a campaign called Take Control of Your HIV. Tell us a little bit more about it and who it impacts.
Well, this campaign really came about based on client input, and I think I can probably put it in context best by telling kind of a client story of someone that really inspired the campaign. And this client I have known for my entire career working in HIV and was probably infected in the 1980s. When I met him, he was pretty ill with opportunistic infections, as we called them at that point. And I don't think expected that he would live much longer. And luckily, he had a great physician, got access to treatment. At the time, we called it heart therapy, and managed his side effects. And when I talked to him a few weeks ago, one of the things he said to me when we were talking about this campaign is, I love getting old. He's going to be 68, and he loves getting his colonoscopy every year because he never thought.
He may be the only one there.
Well, it's one of those things. You celebrate that when you never think it was going to happen to you, that you would have to think about that. Yeah. And for me, clients like him, and there are many, that's one example of people that inspired us. What really made the difference was being engaged in treatment and taking control of their HIV, knowing their status, and really working to improve their health over the course of all of these years, and now they get the joy of saying they're getting old.
So from what you described, did that client have what would be described as full-blown AIDS?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely.
That's kind of what I assumed.
Yeah.
So how did he inspire when you talked about it? Was it that he said that he loved getting old and, you know, he's living for, you know, maybe 30 years with HIV? Was that the inspiration behind this campaign?
Really, him and clients like him, because when you listen to clients that are successful, really, living with HIV, that really is the commonality, is knowing their status early, getting access to treatment, and taking control of that really as a part of their life, but not their entire life. You know, for instance, one of the other things he said to me is, I get to retire. Because HIV really didn't define him. Like, it was a part of who he was, but, you know, he worked full time and finished his degree and did all those other things too. And we think that that really is part of the commonality of people that are able to really thrive still living with HIV. And so that inspired the campaign. If you look at the art, I hope that's what the art campaign, you know, really conveys. There's a vibrancy to it, that it's possible to not just survive, but really to live a wonderful life if you take control of it.
Dr. Lake, this is something that obviously there has been a real transformation in the last 30 years. Just what Ms. Fonzi described, 25 years ago, 20 years ago, that kind of optimism wouldn't have been there. That living with HIV, there would have been a fear of, okay, when does my time come? We've made some great advances.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what started with, one or two medications that had all sorts of side effects and toxicities that you'd have to deal with has really turned into something that, you know, becomes manageable. And at this point, there's a lot of options out there for folks that are living with HIV that are one pill once a day and can get you your virus completely under control within a month a lot of times. So this has drastically changed from, you know, when we initially had things like AZT and some of the earlier medications that you basically had to have a timer go off so that you remember to take your medication 4, 5, 6 times a day, and a lot of times incurring a lot of side effects from that, to now it's one pill once a day and it can be somewhat forgiving. So we've made it's a very different situation than when this was initially being recognized.
When you say within a month you can get your HIV under control, what mm-hmm. does under control mean?
So this is a really important aspect of HIV. So there's something called undetectability. So meaning that the virus is at such a low level when we test your blood that we can't actually give you a number. It's so low that it's below the lowest number that we can actually give you in terms of a count. And why that's become so important is something called U equals U, or undetectable means untransmittable. And what that means is that when you get undetectable, once your virus is completely under control, it means you can't give it to anybody else. So folks that are in relationships means that you can actually, you know, when you're in your most intimate times with somebody, you don't have to worry that you might actually be hurting that person. So you can actually just kind of, you know, have a normal life. And that's a big change for folks who are living with this.
Does that happen today? I mean, because I a lot of the information that the public has, the knowledge of this, probably goes back a few years. And it's one of the reasons we wanted to have this conversation today is to talk about today. Mm-hmm. But used to be that you were infected, you know, you had to take precautions. You probably still do, but still, that I think a lot of people assume that meant any sexual partner you had, for example, that you had to let them know that, hey, I am HIV infected. We're going to have to take some measures here. Mm-hmm. Is that still the case?
So I still recommend that folks, you know, tell their partners about it, because certainly it's something that could get unsafe. Maybe the partner doesn't take it very well, and you know, sometimes become violent or angry, or just, you know, not have a great time. So I always recommend that, hey, you tell somebody about it. But there is also this message, and we've got a number of studies now that really show that once you're undetectable, you're really not giving it to anybody else. So you can really safely kind of have those relationships and not worry so much about transmitting HIV. Now, all the other STDs, it's not just one thing.
Yeah,
so there's still a reason to use protection and to keep it safe. But once you're in kind of a defined relationship, it's not something you need to continue to fear. And I mean, even in terms of that day-to-day interaction, it's not like, you know, casual interactions going to spread this. There aren't HIV outbreaks at a McDonald's. Like, there's no mystery HIV outbreaks. We kind of know where generally things are coming from. You know, you don't get a job at Burger King and need to get tested for HIV, because it doesn't spread that way.
Well, and again, going back a few decades, I mean, that was one of the original fears.
Oh, yeah.
There was a lot of discrimination against those who were HIV positive.
Absolutely.
Because they were people who were afraid that it mm-hmm. would be spread through casual contact.
Absolutely.
I think as a society, we're probably over that. But are we over the stigma, though?
No, I don't think that we're over the stigma. I think that we've got a lot of very reassuring research that, you know, it's even less transmittable than what we had initially worried about. And, you know, we've come a long way from, you know, not being able to be buried in certain cemeteries because they're worried about what happens to the water and is HIV getting to there. And, okay, that's not a concern that anyone seems to voice anymore, but certainly that, you know, we still encounter a lot of, like, the roommates or the family members, like, okay, can they still babysit my children, or, you know, what's the, you know, what precautions do I need to take? And, yeah, it's generally a very reassuring message I get to share.
Patricia, let me get back to the campaign. Something you said that I wanted to follow up on, you said that the treatment is most often successful when caught early, which would mean that testing is still very important.
Absolutely.
Statistic that might catch a lot of people's attention is that of those living with HIV, 1 in 7 don't even know that they are HIV infected. How does that happen? And talk about the importance of getting tested.
Well, I think there is a lack of what I would refer to as universal testing. People make a lot of assumptions about, you know, who gets HIV, and as Adam was just talking about, and those aren't always true. And so, for instance, you may find that heterosexual males are less likely to get tested than other populations because physicians might make an assumption that they don't need to be tested. So if you talk about not just testing, but universal testing as a part of primary care and kind of conversations that people have with their doctor about their real risk for HIV and what that means to be tested and what it would mean if they were positive, becomes really critical at identifying people who really aren't going to assume that they're at risk for HIV until someone mentions it to them because they've made assumptions based on stigma, et cetera. So the idea would be to even remove the stigma around testing, that it's just part of your natural primary care. And, you know, I could say that about all other STDs and a lot of other things, that if you integrate that into the work, that it actually becomes much more natural to talk about that with a client and what testing means for them. So big plug for universal testing.
What goes into an HIV test? Because, I mean, is it as simple as a blood test or what?
Mm-hmm. So we have lots of rapid tests available, which are very convenient because it allows us to go into the community and test at times. There's one that's as fast as a 1 minute finger stick blood test. At our office, we use a mouth swab that gets you a result within 20 minutes. And there's kind of the conventional blood testing that just depends on the turnaround time of the lab, but can be as short as an hour, but often can be a day or two if you're having blood drawn.
But when someone is going in for their physical, their once a year, once every 6 month physical, and they get labs done, blood tests, they're looking for cholesterol, levels of sugar, is HIV part of that?
I think it should be.
Answer is no.
No, it's not. It's not something that that is that common. I think it's becoming increasingly more common. There's been a recent push to try to get the baby boomers tested for hepatitis C. So I think that there's now kind of that precedent and being able to say, okay, there's a one-time test for this sort of thing that, you know, you've been at risk for. Once we know your status, then great, we can move on. But just kind of know where things are at. Normalize it.
We have a question here. Can you talk about PrEP, P-R-E-P, how it works and what can be done to broaden access to this preventative drug?
Happily. So we can't wait to talk about PrEP. Yeah.
So this is one of the big things in HIV prevention. You know, we've been pushing the message about condoms and safe sex for a long time, and we're only getting so much bang for our buck there. It's clearly not completely stopping folks from getting new infections. So now there's something called PrEP, which basically it's pre-exposure prophylaxis. So we're trying to prevent HIV before you're even exposed, kind of like a vaccine, but we don't have a vaccine for HIV. So you can take one pill once a day, and it's pretty reliable in being able to prevent HIV. So even if there's things that are putting you at risk, so the partners that you choose and how you have sex, or even injecting drugs, you can take one pill once a day and have 97% or 99% chance of preventing HIV if you do end up getting exposed. And that's huge.
It's not on the market yet?
Oh, it's been on the market for a number of years. It's a medication that we've known about and been using for probably 15 years
really?
Now.
Really? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But why doesn't it doesn't seem like the public probably knows a whole lot about that.
No, it's not something that that everyone in the public knows about. Certainly within certain communities, it's something that I don't have to explain very much. If somebody's not, say, a young gay man, it's something that, okay, I need to explain kind of how this works and why it'd be recommended. It hasn't been, now this medicine's been out for 15 or 16 years, but mostly to treat HIV. We've only been using it as prevention. I think the studies probably came out 2014, so probably about 5 years, and there's been a kind of steady increase in that. And there's the United States Preventative Services Task Force, which kind of guides us in all these recommended screenings and prevention items, gave this their highest rating. So if anybody is remotely at risk, they highly recommend starting it, just in terms of the risks and benefits of being on this medication.
Something to be prescribed by the doctor?
Yes, and it would be something that you'd want to pair with regular STD testing every 3 months or so.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. For more information on HIV prevention and treatment, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. We are talking today about HIV, living with HIV, treatment. We're going to be talking about housing and caring for those living with HIV in just a moment. Our guest today, Dr. Adam Lake, a family physician at Penn Medicine, Lancaster General Health, and Patricia Fonzi, President and CEO at the Family Health Council of Central Pennsylvania. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You know, I'm kind of jumping around with some of the questions here, but we're covering a lot of territory. Patricia, the campaign Take Control of Your HIV, who is it aimed at?
So it's aimed at people living with HIV, those at risk for HIV, and anyone that loves one of those people is kind of how I say it, because there's lots of great information on there, not just about the things we've talked about so far today, but also about how you can get supportive services and other things that you might need to ensure that you have access to medical care and that you're able to manage your HIV and take control of it.
Something that is very noticeable today in comparison to, say, 20 years ago is the amount of attention that HIV gets in the public. Now, a lot of that probably is a success story because of just what we're talking about today, the advances made, and that it is not a death sentence like AIDS used to be. But at the same time, does that make the public less aware of the potential for becoming infected?
So certainly if something's becoming less deadly, people are going to be a little bit less afraid of it. So the messaging of like, oh, this is not something we need to worry about anymore because we have treatment, I don't think that that's the message that we want to push. But if you are positive, there's, you know, and you know your status and you can get into treatment, then that's something that that it does drastically change your life, mm-hmm. Compared to not knowing your status and continuing to have it progress and potentially giving it to other people. So the message that we're going with is the most important thing is just knowing your status, and if you're positive to get into treatment, and if there's continued risk, than to do something to protect yourself.
Well, again, that's something that is part of this that is very noticeable, is that you don't hear the prevention messages as much. Maybe in some communities you do, but overall, you don't hear as much as you once did. I mean, quite frankly, and it's not us against them or, you know, one disease or illness against another, but you hear much more about breast cancer today, for example, because there are a lot of campaigns for breast cancer awareness. Used to be that you heard prevention messages and you heard AIDS awareness, HIV awareness messages. You don't hear that as often today. What about that?
Well, you know, it's absolutely true. I don't think you hear as much about it. So we kind of jokingly call that like disease du jour syndrome. And it was funny for you to mention hepatitis and the testing around that is, you know, there's almost a theory the public can only absorb kind of so much information. And once it becomes kind of old news, it becomes, there's less of a headline about it. We don't have celebrities dying of HIV. I mean, you think about the things that drove that. You know, it was ACT UP activists protesting at the FDA to have access to expedited clinical trials. I mean, those were the things that got the news headlines if you think about it, was people dying. So in some ways, you're right. It's good that we don't see headlines like that. It's one of the reasons we wanted to launch this campaign, is to really put out there the face of HIV today. And while it's still very, very important, very different, but very important that you know your status and seek treatment and take control of it, and for all different reasons than it was 20 years ago. You know, this isn't, Adam and I were talking about kind of charting your career in HIV. The beginning of my career was all about helping people really plan to die. And how long that would be really depended on so many things, you know, how well they were when they got infected and other behaviors. But really the focus of even the services we provided were things like hospice care and nutritional supplements. We spent tons of money on Ensure, things like that, you know, when you look at how you spend the money. And then in the middle, it became, you know, what Adam was talking about, the management, that side effect part of things, and just how hard that was. But now it's like the third phase. So we have to figure out what the messages are to the public, that this isn't the same stigma. It isn't the same disease. It isn't the same treatment. But that doesn't mean that it's not critically as important, really. And it really is to the testament of physicians, you know, like Adam and the other docs that we've worked with in Central PA, especially over the years, that have made that possible. But I totally agree. We have to do more around what HIV prevention looks like today.
The Family Health Council of Central Pennsylvania, one of the things that you say is prevention, care, and housing. We've talked a little bit about prevention. Talked a little bit about care. What about housing? I mean, this was a huge issue years ago in that, and this goes back to the stigma of, you know, there were people who didn't want to be around other people who were HIV infected. Is that still an issue today, that housing is a challenge?
Yes.
Really?
But again, I think it's changed. I'd love to, I love talking about housing, like our housing program. We administer a program that's a housing first model for people with HIV. So pretty much after they see Dr. Lake, they come see us, and we need to figure out what we need to do to make sure that their housing is safe and stable. Because again, it's, you know, where do the homeless keep their medicines, and how do they even manage, you know, their recovery, for instance, while they're also trying to find housing. So we put forth housing subsidies that actually mirror Section 8, except they also include for people that are living with HIV. And the aim of that is to ensure their treatment, really, and that they can have access to care and remove barriers to that. We serve quite over 200 people in the mid-state through those funds. And, you know, I will say that that's one of those things we're very careful that landlords don't know necessarily that someone's living with HIV. We actually have a lot of housing programs, which helps that, you know, so if you're getting a check for us for housing, it's not necessarily for HIV, but we work really hard to allow the clients the confidentiality, because it is still a concern. And, you know, truthfully, it's more of a concern in some communities. You know, some communities are much more able to talk about HIV and you know, really have an understanding of that and are more supportive. And others, there's still some stigma there. So yeah, we work very hard, really, not just in housing, all our services, to maintain our client confidentiality. It's paramount, really, to the services that we provide.
Well, my question was, how would a would-be landlord know anyway that someone was HIV infected?
Oh, believe me. Well, you know, I'll give you one example of something that, and again, this hasn't happened in the recent past, but about 5 years ago, a landlord came in and saw the medications. And again, you know, the meds labeled with the client's name in a big circle on the table, and they obviously knew what that was for. Now, can you prove that if you made them, you know, in a court of law, can I prove that that was why that landlord chose to not renew that client's lease? Of course I can't. But does that what the client feels, that after the landlord came in, that they treated him differently and then they decide to not renew their lease, and, you know, then the client has to find a security deposit and move? So again, it doesn't happen often, and I think that for the most part, it's not an issue, but for the clients that it is, it can be the difference between homelessness and access to care and not. So
let's take a phone call from Clara in Glen Rock. Clara, you're on the air.
Hi, everybody. I just had a comment. I grew up, I was born in 79, and I grew up in Philadelphia, and everybody knew about AIDS and HIV. I mean, I learned about it in Girl Scouts, and now my teenage boys look at me like, Mom, like, what are you talking about? And I have to educate them on something that I was taught very early on about. So I'm glad that you're doing the show.
Clara, thank you very much for your call, because I think you point out something that exactly what that we were talking about, that, you know, depending on when you did grow up, and as Clara said, she was seven in the 80s, in 86, and, you know, heard the messages all the time. I mean, we were hearing those messages all the time about protection for sex and intravenous drug use and that kind of thing. I mean, I even remember back when the first AIDS cases appeared and they thought it was coming from Haiti. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, very early on. But what she says about talking to her own children, first of all, it's a good idea, because not just about HIV, but some of those STDs or some of the other things that are out there. But it just goes to show how far we have come and maybe how much farther we need to come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think that the way that the sexual education has changed over the years in terms of the focus, and it's something that I think has impacted a lot of the, you know, this current generation, of not necessarily understanding the importance of getting tested, or, you know, safe sex and what that means, or even basic things like consent and these other issues that we're starting to really need to approach now. And it's not something that's been kind of modeled and taught in schools in the same way as maybe it had been in years past.
It when you look at how HIV is spread, still the majority of cases are through male sexual contact. Intravenous drug use, there still is, it's spread heterosexually. Usually that's the way that most women contract HIV, is through heterosexual sex. Question that I'm curious about, you know, the last few years we've been talking a whole lot about the opioid crisis. A lot of people using needles with when they're shooting heroin. I would assume, or let me just ask the question, that there has been an increase in HIV cases through intravenous drug use. Is that the case?
I think it's kind of just waiting to happen at this point.
The answer's not yet.
Yeah, but not yet.
You think it will?
We've had it, but... We've had it in different areas. So I think, was it Indiana?
Yes.
Had a big outbreak, and it was basically all tied to one or two folks, but over 100 people ended up getting diagnosed with HIV. So, you know, people are still injecting drugs, and we can use, you know, other things that are transmitted by blood or sharing needles, like hepatitis C, and see that, yeah, hepatitis C, that's definitely kind of still on the rise, and we're still seeing new cases of that. So if we use that as a marker of things that could be transmitted by blood, like HIV, it's just waiting for the right person to walk into that storm and set off that powder keg, and all of a sudden some county is going to have a whole lot of HIV that they're going to have to kind of find a way to address. And there's ways to address it, but politically they're just very challenging to institute.
When I donate blood, everyone who has donated blood is asked those questions up front, pre-screened. One of the questions is if you have had sex, you know, with, in my case, another male. Have you, another question, visited another country, intravenous drug use? Those questions, I mean, first of all, if you tell the truth, that's fine. But if someone doesn't, I mean, I guess the question, are those questions still necessary?
To a degree.
I think it helps them screen the supply of blood, because I think what they do, depending on the answers, it may be disposed of, right? Like there's a secondary screening to that, but of course it's all tested.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, that was my
right.
next
it's
question.
It's all tested.
It's still tested.
So, you know, we don't encourage people to use giving blood as a method of HIV mm-hmm. testing, but I will tell you, for a long time, that was a very common way that people were finding out that they were HIV positive. because they would go to give blood. And we've actually gotten better at screening people and making kind of a referral based on that. You know, I will tell you, though, that because it's been tested, there are clients of ours that feel marginalized, specifically men who have sex with men, who feel like that behavior has been, it's been kind of singled out around risk and has barred them from giving blood, even though there may be critical need for it and everything is tested. So, you know, I think it's complicated because obviously we want the safest blood supply possible, but we also want, you know, as many donors as possible that are safe. And it does enhance the stigma of people, you know, if you've traveled to Haiti, right? Mm-hmm. Even though we know now that's very different than the risk used to be. But it does enhance the stigma, I would say, of people. It's like one more thing that people can't do based on behaviors, and it has nothing really to do with HIV, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, those who are trying to protect the blood supply, I guess the reason I ask the question is because if the blood is tested, why the need for those questions? And I guess what you're saying is it just kind of helps pre-screen. Mm-hmm. When someone, you said that there were people who, that's how they were being tested, is by giving blood. My guess would be part of that would be because of cost. What does it cost to get an HIV test?
It's free.
It is free.
Yeah, you can walk in today to my office in Lancaster and get a test in 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And other places, you know, there's a number of places that will test you. Point of care, you know, get your result before you leave the door. For free, and there's ample grants to be able to do that. One of the reasons why people were using the blood supply to get tested was because that was the first place that they actually had a test for HIV. So back in the 80s, when there wasn't, you know, you couldn't go into your doctor and get tested for HIV, that was the way that you could know your status. You could donate blood, and they would tell you if you had HIV. So once that started to become known and become used, then they said, whoa, okay, we need to make sure other people have access to testing another way, because there is going to be a little window period right after you become infected that you could potentially not test positive, but could still have the virus in the blood. So it's a very small window. It's getting smaller and smaller the better our tests get.
I have not heard of a case of someone becoming infected through a blood transfusion or getting blood. That almost never happens today?
I don't remember the last time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think there was a case of maybe two people in 2011 or something, and I really haven't heard of a single one since in the U.S. Mm-hmm. or the developed world.
I see. I was wondering about other, you know, mm-hmm. overseas. We know mm-hmm. in Africa, for example, that HIV and AIDS has been just a huge issue. Mm-hmm. The United States has helped in reducing those cases, but I know it's still an issue mm-hmm. overseas. Mm-hmm. By the way, if you're just tuning in, our guest today, Patricia Fonzi, President and CEO at the Family Health Council of Central Pennsylvania, Dr. Adam Lake, a family physician at Penn Medicine Lancaster General Health. We're talking about HIV infection and living with HIV and treatments. If you have a question, give us a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org on Twitter. We are at smarttalk. WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So I want to talk about some of the advances that we have made in the treatment of HIV. I mean, there's actually something today. It sounded like it was almost a pipe dream years ago. I hate to keep going back in the past, but, you know, in the last 20 or 30 years, we have made so many advancements. Mm-hmm. But actually, it seems as though on the horizon that I don't know whether I want to call it a cure or not, but there could be treatment that would eradicate the HIV virus. How close on the horizon?
So we have two folks that we've actually been able to cure from HIV, and both folks had really horrendous blood cancers, you know, a leukemia and a lymphoma, respectively, and basically had their entire immune system irradiated, and had a bone marrow transplant, and they selected the bone marrow transplant to be something somebody who's naturally kind of resistant to the virus. Now, we've done that a number of other times, and it hasn't really worked, and we've... You know, these couple cures, whether they're in humans, or there's a recent study at from Temple where they were able to do a similar sort of thing in mice. Those are things that, you know, they give you some optimism, but these are very kind of proof of concept. And because we know that, okay, it worked in, say, 2 out of 7 mice instead of 7 out of 7, it means that we've still got some work to do, but it is promising that we have some leads that are a little bit more promising than what we've had before, because there's been a lot of false starts in terms of like, oh, this could be the cure, this could be the secret sauce of how we're going to be able to actually eliminate this from the body. Some people out there might remember a story 4 years ago of she was called the Mississippi Baby. We thought maybe she had been cured by very aggressive treatment early on. But then it kind of turned out that, okay, you know, about 2 years off of treatment, it came back. And that's kind of what we're looking for is, okay, not only can we eliminate it, but is it still going to be an effective cure later on? And, you know, we've got such good tools to prevent it and such good tools to treat it if it's identified, that the cure is kind of a whole separate ball of wax. And we're trying not to hype it too much, but yeah, I do like that research, and it's exciting.
And Dr. Lake, I don't want to, you're not a researcher, but you're actually on the ground treating patients, but I'm sure that you stay up to date with the research out there. What about stem cell transplants?
So stem cell transplants, so the stem cells would have to be able to take root in a person. So if we're doing kind of a bone marrow transplant type thing or stem cell transplant, you basically have to irradiate your whole natural immune system, which comes with a whole lot of risk, much more risk than just the one pill once a day type of medications we have to treat the HIV. So it's not something that we're going to be doing anytime soon. At least not until we have a whole lot of the kinks worked out and a much safer way to do it than what we're looking at currently.
What about gene therapy?
So gene therapy, there's something called CRISPR that has gotten a lot of attention in the press. There was one that somebody had edited a human embryo, and then that child was apparently born and is healthy. I think the same scientist in China did it twice. And actually, the gene that they were editing was specific to HIV. Now, the ability to do this in an adult and not have any untoward side effects is still kind of a ways away. And what we know from other studies is that if you already have an HIV infection and then you try to do that, that doesn't necessarily take care of it once it's established. So still a little bit more work to do, but certainly there's a lot of research going into that.
More than 500 people died of AIDS in Pennsylvania, I believe, is in 2017. So it obviously still can be fatal. Mm-hmm. When does an HIV infection turn into, as referred to or described, as full-blown AIDS?
99% of the time, if you don't take any medication for it. If you don't know your status, and or if you know it and you're not taking medication, it's going to eventually turn into AIDS, and it's going to go pretty poorly, and you can definitely die from it. I'm not aware personally of anybody that we care for at our clinic that was on treatment and trying to treat it and still ended up dying of complications from HIV or AIDS. So fortunately, it's something that that if you're in treatment and you're engaging in that, and we can almost always find a medication that's going to work for you. Mm.
I want to thank both of you for being with us today. Message that you'd like to leave with the audience?
Well, I think, you know, I would let the campaign speak for itself. You know, please visit it, take control, HIV.com. Happy to get your feedback on it. There's a place where you can sign up if you want more information. If you're living with HIV or don't know your status but want more information of those, there's a little form you can fill out anonymously, and we'd be happy to help get you connected to care.
So that's the easiest way. If you want to get tested, go to the website and rather now, you know, doctor, like you said, you could just walk into your office and get tested. I assume that can happen anywhere.
It's kind of hard to walk into any doctor's office.
Right, just
and
walk up to the receptionist and say, hey, I want to get HIV tested.
It should happen more.
More. There's generally going to be a place close by, and there's a number of sites out there. I don't have a specific one in mind, but finding a free HIV test that can be done that same day or that at least that week is shouldn't be a challenge. Mm-hmm.
We did have a quick question, I wonder, because it's an important one. Peter asked about the free testing. How accurate are the tests?
Over 99% accurate. A lot of the point of care tests, we still do want to confirm it with the most accurate tests that we have. But certainly false positives are becoming vanishingly rare with the newer technology.
Our guest today, Dr. Adam Lake, a family physician at Penn Medicine Lancaster General Health, and Patricia Fonzi, president and CEO at the Family Health Council of Central Pennsylvania. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. It was great.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. A proposed ordinance that would require horses to wear a device to collect manure and rubber horseshoes when pulling the buggies of Old or Order Amish has been put on hold for the time being in Washington Township, Lycoming County. Township supervisors say they had gotten complaints about manure on the roads presenting a health hazard and that normal metal horseshoes damaged roads. Joining us on the line right now is attorney Clifford Readers. He represents a group of Amish Pennsylvanians in Washington Township that opposed that ordinance in that township. Mr. Readers, welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. So why do your clients oppose this proposed ordinance?
Well, they oppose it because it's against their religious obligations. And the Amish are guided in particular by what they call the oral law, sometimes referred to as the Ordnung, and to which they subscribe twice a year. And it's very key. They cannot remain part of the church without subscribing to that. And that includes their way of life. And their way of life means using horses and carriages unimpeded. The United States Supreme Court has addressed Amish rights in the famous Yoder decision and has spelled out very carefully and very clearly what those rights consist of. So this is clearly a burden on their religious rights and their religious freedom. Both Pennsylvania and the United States of America have specific legislation, by the way, that indicate that a state or a municipality cannot burden religious practice unless they can show a compelling state interest and unless they've used the least restrictive means possible. So it's our position, the position of my clients, that that is certainly not satisfied in any way whatsoever.
So when you're talking about restricting the Amish freedom of religion, I mean, those are words that are protected by the U.S. Constitution in the First Amendment. Do you see this ordinance as a violation of the First Amendment?
Well, it's not up to me. Clearly, it is a violation. We have been working with the leading expert on the Amish in the world, Dr. Craybill from Elizabethtown College, who has put in writing, and we've given that to the township, that it is a violation. And there's nobody in the country who's more knowledgeable. He's testified in a number of these, you know, these leading, these key cases, and he's, you know, written all of the leading literature with respect to the Amish. So it's not my opinion. My opinion is irrelevant. I mean, that is the reality. That is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I might also add, there is nothing in writing. We have done a Freedom of Information Act request to the township, and the response, which we received which was dated July 29, 2019, indicates, and I'll just quickly read it to you, there's no studies about damage. There are no studies about any health concern. There are no studies concerning any manure on the roads. No emails, they claim, between employees, supervisors, staff, secretary, or anyone else. There's nothing. Absolutely nothing. And, you know, we have talked to veterinarians. We've talked to health officials. There is no health issue whatsoever. In terms of the condition of the roads, I'm an avid bicycle rider, so I ride throughout these valleys here, and I can tell you the roads in Washington Township are better than the roads anywhere in the area up north. The Amish have kept those communities beautiful, pristine, clean. They take a tremendous amount of pride, and they've really actually upgraded the township, not made it worse. So we have seen no evidence. At the hearing held August 5th, there were a few people who said they had oral complaints. They all seemed to be related to one supervisor and one family. And that particular family apparently has some kind of gripe, and they claim that they have seen or encountered manure on the roads. Now, I will tell you that what I did myself is I rode a buggy through the township roads. I wanted to see what it was like, and I went with one of the Amish, and I not once saw any manure on the roads. And as I said, I've biked extensively through that township, and I've seen no manure on those roads. And in fact, the Amish do send some of their people to try to clean up anything obvious if they find it.
Mm-hmm. Metal horseshoes wearing down the pavement, though, when you say that you have ridden
nothing to that.
Well, nothing to that at all. Where the people, when we've heard about this complaint, and I think the supervisors have said this, it is that the wears down the pavement and makes it hazardous for motorcycles.
Yeah, so that's what they claim. No, that's not what they're saying. They're saying that manure on the road is hazardous to motorcycles, of which, again, there's no evidence whatsoever that they were able to come up with on that. No, what they're saying is that the metal horseshoes damage the asphalt. Also, no evidence of that whatsoever. They showed a copy of a picture made on a copy machine, so you really couldn't tell, one picture, and it looked to me and to others like dirt on the road. So there's no evidence of that. I mean, they can say whatever they want to say, but now you're restricting somebody's rights aggressively, and you're threatening serious fines against them. There ought to be something of record. There ought to be some legitimate photographs. There ought to be some a report of somebody. And I can tell you, we've seen the reports of Ohio, Pennsylvania, of other departments of transportation have looked into this, and nobody's found a substantial problem. The reason for that is that to the extent that the metal make any marks at all, it is repressed by the passage of trucks and cars. And this is asphalt, and as people know who are listening, it is not permanently affected by the very minor mark of a horse. What does hurt the roads, what does affect the roads, of course, is all the gas drilling and these very, very heavy trucks. The heavy truck traffic does destroy the berms of these roads, but not the shoes on these horses. And we had farriers just available. We had farrier from Hershey, retired gentleman, somebody who runs a carriage service down there. There's just nothing to those claims.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, even if they still would have to prove a least restrictive means and that it's compelling, there's a compelling reason to pass these restrictions anyway.
Hmm. So we only have about 2 minutes left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
No problem.
A lot of people have referred to this ordinance as diapers, that the horses would be fitted with diapers. I mean, is that actually what we're talking about here?
That's what you're talking about. It's absolutely absurd. These horses cannot be fitted that way. It would be dangerous to fit them that way. Actually, it would be dangerous to motorists. And I can tell you, riding in a buggy, do it sometime if you haven't done it, or your listeners should do it. Most traffic, people are very disrespectful. Just on the 3 mile trips that we took, motorists go flying by. I didn't see one motorist slow down, going or coming. The motorists are the danger. And a big danger. And so, really people are afraid and they're scared and suspicious of the other. And to them, the Amish are cute and quaint when they're selling apples, but they don't really want them living in their community if they don't bring in a lot of tourism because they're different. They're scary to people who are really don't know. The Amish have greatly enhanced those communities, and people testified to that. They help people with barns. They help people with their animals. They do check the roads to make sure things are okay. They try when they can have the horses on the berms, and the berms are big enough. I mean, they're extremely respectful of the people they live with, and they have tremendously upgraded these communities. It's a completely bogus issue. I really don't know where these supervisors are coming from or why or what their motives are, but I will tell you, if you want to know about motive, there was a big sign, and even their solicitor, and I give him a lot of credit for this, their solicitor even was upset about this big sign in the center of Elamsport, center of town. Let's take our township back. Come to meeting, and is a skull and crossbones, six of them, three on each side of the sign. That's what's going on. And I suspect that one family put that up, the family who is seems to have the objection here. But that's what this is really all about. It's about hatred, fear, and suspicion of the other, of the different. And I give credit to their solicitor for speaking up against that. Mm.
Clifford Readers is the attorney representing a group of Amish in Washington Township, Lycoming County. We'll continue to follow this. Mr. Readers, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank
Bye.
You very much.